Till that petition is answered and she is back on the Rocinante, the Edward Israel and all RCE personnel and employees are advised to do everything in their power to avoid any further escalation of this situation. This message serves as a final verbal notification before the actions I've outlined are taken. A copy of this message is being included in the packet to the UN and RCE's corporate headquarters. Thank you. The round-faced, balding man looked into the camera for a moment, then away, and then back before the recording ended. Marwick sighed. "Not the most professional production," he said, "but made his points effectively enough, I'd say."
"Sneeze and he shoots us," Havelock said. "Look like we're going to sneeze and he shoots us.
Make sure his chief engineer doesn't catch cold or he shoots us. Give her a blankie at night and a cup of warm milk or he shoots us."
"Oh, did have a certain sameness to his thinking, didn't he?"
Marwick said. Havelock looked around the cabin. The captain's rooms were smaller than the security station, but he placed steel mirrors at the sides and along the tops of the walls to make it feel big. It was an illusion, of course, but it was the kind of illusion that could make the difference between sanity and madness over the course of a few years in confined spaces. The screen set into the wall hiccuped and shifted to a starscape. Not the real one outside, but the one from Sol. Seeing the old constellations was disconcerting.
"Who's seen this?" Havelock asked.
"Sent to me in Murtry," Marwick said. "Don't know who Murtry's shown it to, but I've run it past you."
"All right," Havelock said. "What do you want me to do about it?"
"Want? I want you to pop the lady free and set her back home with a stern talking to," Marwick said. "After that, I want to get my ship back under thrust and go the hell home the way my contract said. What I expect is that you find out whether this is really all talk, or if my ship's going to come under fire."
"They have the firepower.
I'm deeply aware of that, but do they have the will and expertise to use it? I'm only asking because the lives of my crew are in threat here, and it's making me a bit nervous."
"I understand," Havelock said.
"Do you now?"
"I do, and I'll find out what I can. But in the meantime, let's start by assuming that he means it."
"Yeah," Marwick said, running a hand through his hair. He sighed. "When I signed up for this, I was thinking it was a hell of an adventure. First alien world. No stations or relief ships if things went pear-shaped. A whole new system full to the top with Christ only knows what. And instead I get this shite."
"Right there with you, sir," Havelock said.
Havelock's paintball militia, emboldened by the capture, had pressed for immediate action. They had the emergency airlock. The orbital mechanics of the Rocinante had clearly brought it close enough for a transit. "Go now," they'd said. "Take the Rocinante when they weren't expecting it and get the whole charade over with." Havelock had been tempted. If he hadn't seen what point defense cannons could do to a human body, he might have given the go-ahead. Instead, they'd pulled the power on the prisoner's suit and hauled her back to the Israel before she suffocated. Since then, she'd been in the drunk tank cell in Havelock's office. With the security team down to less than a skeleton crew, he'd given the prisoner access to the privacy controls. He didn't have enough women left on the team to put one on guard duty full-time. In fact, when he got back to his office, the place was empty except for Nagata in her cell. She looked over, greeting him with a little chin lift. She wore a red paper jumpsuit, and her hair floated around her head in a dark starburst. Enemy capture protocol didn't allow her hairband, a hand terminal, or her own clothes. She'd been in the cell for the better part of 2 days. Havelock knew from training exercises that he'd have been half crazed with claustrophobia by now. She'd gone from looking embarrassed to retreating into her own thoughts. It was a Belter thing, he assumed. A few generations living and dying without a sky, and enclosed spaces lost the atavistic terror of premature burial. He sloped across the room to her.
"Nagata," he said, "I had some questions for you.
Don't I have the right to an attorney or union representative?"
she asked, her voice making it clear that she was at least half-joking.
You do, Havelock said.
But I was hoping you'd help me out of your kind and generous spirit. Her laugh was sharp, short, and insincere. He pulled up the video file on his hand terminal and set it floating just outside the steel mesh of the cell door.
My name is Alex Kamal, and I am acting captain of the Rosinante. In light of recent events...
Havelock shifted back to his desk, strapping himself in at the couch from force of habit more than anything. He watched Naomi's face without actually staring at her. The woman had a great poker face. It was hard to tell whether she felt anything at all as she watched her shipmate of years threaten them all on her behalf. When the file ended, he reached out and pulled the hand terminal back to himself.
Don't see what you need me for, she said. He used small words.
You're hilarious. The question I have is this. Are you really going to let your shipmates turn themselves into criminals and murderers so that you can postpone answering for your crimes? Her smile could have meant anything, but he had the sense he'd touched on something, or close to it.
I feel like you're asking me for something, friend, but I don't quite know what it is.
Will you tell the Rosinante to back off? Havelock said. It won't do you any damage. It's not like we're letting you go regardless, and if you cooperate, that'll speak well for you when we get back to Earth.
I can, but it won't matter.
You haven't shipped with those men.
When you listen to that, you hear a list of threats, right?
What do you hear?
Alex saying how it is, Naomi said.
All that stuff he told you? Those are just axioms now.
I'm sorry to hear you say that, Havelock said.
Still, if you'll record something for him, assuring him that you're in good condition and aren't being mistreated, it'll only help.
She shifted, the microcurrents of air and the constant drift of microgravity bringing her back against the cell's far wall.
She touched it gently, steadying herself.
Alex isn't the problem, she said.
Let me tell you a little about Jim Holden.
All right, Havelock said.
He's a good man, but he doesn't turn on a dime. Right now there's a debate going on in his head. On the one hand, he was sent out here to make peace, and he wants to do that. On the other hand, he protects his own.
His woman?
His crew, Naomi said, biting the words a little. It's going to take him a while to decide to stop doing what he agreed to do and just tip over the table.
Havelock's hand terminal chimed. It was a reminder to review the next week's schedules. Even in the depths of crises, minor office tasks demanded their tribute.
He pulled up the scheduling grid.
You think he will, though? Havelock said.
He's got Amos with him, Naomi said, as if that explained everything. And then they'll assault the ship and get me out.
Havelock laughed.
We're stretched a little thin, but I don't see how they can expect to get through to you.
You're talking about the man who got a load of people off Ganymede when it was still a war zone, Naomi said, and went onto the alien station at Medina by himself, and scuttled the Agatha King by himself when it had 2,000 protomolecule zombies on it. He fought his way off Eros in the first outbreak.
Rushing in where angels fear to tread, Havelock said,
and making it through. I can't tell you how many last goodbyes I've had with him. And he always comes back.
Sounds like a rough guy to have for a boyfriend, Havelock said.
He is, actually, she said with a laugh. But he's worth it.
Why?
Because he does what he says he's going to do, she said. And if he says he's going to pop me out of this cell, then either that will happen, or he'll die.
Her expression was calm. Her tone, matter of fact. She wasn't boasting. If anything, he thought there was a hint of apprehension in her voice. It disturbed him more than the acting captain's list of threats. He closed the scheduling grid, considered his hand terminal for a few seconds. It would be afternoon on the surface, a little over halfway through one of the long 15-hour days. "Excuse me," they said to the prisoner. "I've got to make a call." He thumbed the privacy controls down, and the steel mesh of the cage deformed into a pearly opacity. He requested a connection to Mercury, and a few seconds later his boss appeared on the screen. The sun had darkened his skin, and a tiny scab on his forehead looked almost like a caste mark. He nodded to Havelock.
"What can I do for you?"
Mercury said.
"I wanted to touch base with you about the prisoner," Havelock said. "Check our strategy."
"Saw the pilot's little tantrum, did you? You know, boss, all that you said before about how they have the biggest guns and if they want to take us down, they can. Because that's still true."
In the background of the feed, a door slammed and Mercury looked up, nodded, and refocused on Havelock.
"Less an issue now than ever. As long as one of theirs is on the ship, they won't shoot."
"Won't?"
"We'll be less likely to," Mercury amended.
"And what's the plan when RCE orders us to release her?" Havelock said.
"It might be worth cutting her loose early. Get out in front of it. Get some goodwill back." "We're way past goodwill."
"I'm just not sure we have the authority to hold her, and if..."
"Are you in her brig?"
Havelock blinked. "Sorry?"
"Are you in her brig?"
"No, sir."
"Right. She's in yours. You have the jail, and you have the pistol. That makes you the sheriff," Mercury said. "If the Home Office doesn't like what we're doing, we'll appeal the decisions. If we lose the appeal, they can send someone out and have a meeting face to face. By that time, all this will look so different, they might as well not try. And the Home Office knows that, Havelock. What we've got here is a very free hand."
"Yeah, all right, I just wanted to check."
"My door's always open,"
Mercury said in a voice that meant maybe Havelock shouldn't bother him with any more stupid ideas. The connection dropped, and Havelock considered the default screen for a few seconds before he pulled the grid back up. A few seconds later, he deactivated the privacy shield. Naomi was floating in the cage, pushing herself from side to side like a bored kid.
"Your privacy equipment sucks," she said.
"Really?"
"Really."
"You heard that then?"
"A very free hand," she said.
"Sorry, that was supposed to be between me and him."
"I know, but it came right through.
Honestly, can you hear me peeing in here?"
"Just that the vacuum comes on,"
Havelock said, feeling a little blush in his neck and a sharp embarrassment at being embarrassed.
"It's pretty loud."
"Old ships," she said. He went back to the business of running his staff. A report came in complaining of theft from one of the ship's technicians' personal lockers. He routed it to the woman on duty. As long as things stayed pretty calm and the crew was all focused on the dangers outside, he could hold the place together. Having a common enemy actually helped with that. A lot of common enemies. Naomi started humming to herself, a soft melody that hovered just on the edge of recognizable. Havelock let himself enjoy it a little. It was that or be annoyed.
"He wasn't the only one," he said.
"Sorry?" Naomi said.
"He wasn't the only one who got off Eros during the outbreak. My old partner was there. He got off too. Then he went back later, when it hit Venus."
"Wait. You knew Miller?"
"Yeah," Havelock said.
"Small universe."
"He was one of maybe six decent people working Ceres Station when Star Helix had the contract. Warned me to quit Protogen before they imploded too. I was sorry about it when he died."
"He'll be flattered," she said.
"We're not the bad guys here. RCE didn't start any of this. You said you liked Holden because he always does what he says he'll do. That's us. RCE are the ones who asked permission and made a plan and came out here to do what everyone agreed we should do. Not the people in First Landing. They didn't agree.
No, because they were breaking the rules that we were following. I know how weird and dangerous this all is, but before your friends start blasting railgun rounds through our reactor, I want you to see that we're not the bad guys here.
His voice had gotten thinner and higher as he spoke. At the end, he was almost shouting. He pressed his hands together, bit his lips.
Under a little pressure, she said.
Some, he agreed.
Let me out. I'll put in a good word for you, she said. And it'll keep Holden from doing anything stupid.
Really?
It'll keep him from doing a couple particular stupid things, she said. He may come up with something else. He's clever that way.
I can't, he said.
I know.
The ship passed invisibly into the planet's shadow, the decks clicking and groaning as the expansion plates adjusted to the change in radiant heat. Havelock felt a little rush of shame. She was his prisoner. He was the jailer. He shouldn't need her approval. If she thought he and his people were baby-killing fascist power freaks, it didn't change anything he had to do. Naomi went back to humming. It was a different song now. Something slow in a minor key. After a while, she let it drift into silence. They weren't the only ones, she said as he finished the week's duty roster. They were the only ones that were trapped in the outbreak, but the place was locked down before that. A bunch of thugs in stolen riot armor making sure everyone did what they were told, and shooting the ones who didn't, getting ready for it. A few people made it past them.
Really? Who?
Naomi shrugged.
Me, she said.
Chapter 27. Elvie. Elvie sat on the crest of the hill looking west. The morning light behind her caught the wings of thousands of butterfly-like animals. She hadn't seen them before. But today they filled the air from the ground to 20 meters high. A vast school of tiny animals, or insects, or whatever other name humanity eventually assigned to this foreign kingdom of life. For her, right now, they were butterflies. They moved together like a school of fish, independent and coherent. Bursts of color, blue and silver and crimson and green, flashed through them, seeming almost to come in patterns for a moment, and then dissolving into chaos. The column of them rose, narrowing, then broadened and flattened. They moved past her in a rush, and for a few seconds she was inside the cluster, palm-sized wings fluttering gently against her with a sound like sheets of paper falling, and a clean, astringent smell like mint without being mint. She smiled and raised her arms up into the cloud of them, taking joy in the beauty and the moment. And then they passed, and she turned to watch them flow through the air, tumbling to the south as if they were going somewhere in particular. She stood and stretched, adjusting her collection satchel against her hip. The sunlight pressed against her shoulders and the nape of her neck as she walked forward into the dusty, stone-paved field. The ruins rose to the north, with First Landing not even a smudge next to them. All human artifacts hidden by the curve of the planet and the shape of the hills. All except her. Here and there, a few butterflies remained, possibly dead, possibly quiescent. She squatted beside one, looking into the vibrant blue of its wings, the coppery complication of flesh where its body, what she thought of as its body, folded together, interarticulated like a hinge. She put on her gloves and lifted the tiny body. It didn't so much as flutter. Even though it meant getting less physiological data, she hoped it was already dead.
Sorry, little one, she said, just in case. It's in the name of science.
She folded it into the black lattice, sealed it, and triggered the collection sequence.
The array of sampling needles clicked and muttered to themselves. Elvie squinted up into the white-blue arch of the sky. The red dot floated about 15 degrees above the horizon, bright enough to show through the thin, greenish clouds. The satchel coughed, throwing out an error code Elvie hadn't seen before. She took out her hand terminal, connecting it to the satchel's output channel. The preliminary data set was a mess. Elvie felt a deep, cold stab of fear. If the satchel was broken, it could take days before the one functioning shuttle could bring her a spare from the Israel. She wasn't even positive they had a spare in the toolkit, or if they'd all been lost in the wreck of the heavy shuttle. The prospect of years going by collecting data by hand and spending her nights doing dissections like she was back in lower university reared up like a ghost. She took the butterfly out. Its corpse looked almost the same as when she'd put it in. She sat cross-legged beside it and ran the satchel system's diagnostics, chewing her lips as she waited for a fresh error code. The readout came up clean. She looked from the satchel to the butterfly, then back again. A second hypothesis formed, as chilling as the first, maybe worse. She picked up the dead butterfly and marched back toward the huts. Fayez's was a small green geodesic design he'd constructed halfway down a thin hill, high enough that any storm runoff would pass it by, but not at the crest where the wind would catch it. He was sitting on a stool, leaning back against the hut. He was wearing a pair of polyfiber work pants, a t-shirt, and an open bathrobe. He hadn't shaved in days, and the stubble on his cheeks made him look older. "This isn't an animal," she said, holding out the butterfly. He let the stool come down, its legs tapping the ground.
"Good to see you too," he said.
"This isn't two biomes coming together. It's three. This, whatever it is, it doesn't have any of the chemical or structural commonalities that you'd expect to see."
"Lucia Merton was up looking for you. Did you run across her?"
"What? No, look, this is another machine. It's another thing, like..." She pointed at the low red moon. "Like that."
"All right."
"What if they're really not coming awake just because we're here? What if they're consistent? It complicates everything."
Fayez scratched his scalp just above his left ear.
"You seem to want something here, Elvie, but I don't know what it is."
"How am I supposed to make any sense of this place when it keeps changing all the rules?" she said,
and her voice sounded shrill even to her. She threw the butterfly down angrily, then immediately wished she hadn't. Not that it cared, just that the gesture seemed cruel. Fayez smiled his sharp little smile.
"You're preaching to the choir.
You know what I've been doing all morning?
Drinking?
I wish.
I've been going over surface data from the Israel. There's a chain of islands on the far side of the planet with what looks like a metric ass-ton of volcanic activity. Only, so far as I can tell, this planet doesn't have, you know, tectonic plates.
So what the hell is mimicking volcanism?
Do you know what Michaela's working on?"
"No."
"There's a pattern in the ultraviolet light that reaches the ground here, like it's some kind of carrier signal. Doesn't exist before the sunlight hits the exosphere, and by the time it comes here, complex, consistent patterning. She's got no idea where it's coming from."
"Sudyam's work group has what they think might be complex molecules that incorporate stable transuranics."
"How does that work?"
"I know, right?" Fayez said.
Elvie hung her hand on her shoulder, letting her elbow hang loose. Sweat trickled down her spine.
"I have to..."
"Tell Holden," Fayez said. "I know.
I was going to say review my data. See if maybe there's a common structure between that," she nodded at the butterfly, "and the big thing in the desert. Maybe I can make sense of it."
"If you can't, no one can. Fayez said. Something in his voice caught her attention, and she looked at him more closely. His fox-sharp face looked softer around the eyes and jowls. The flesh around his eyes was puffier than usual. Are you all right? He laughed and spread his arms toward the horizon, gesturing at the whole planet, the whole universe at once. I'm great! Just spiffy. Thanks for asking. I'm sorry, I just don't, Elvie, he said. Don't be sorry. Just go on dealing with all of this the way that you do. Pile on another few layers of not thinking about it and sail on, my dear, sail on. Whatever keeps you sane and functioning in a place like this, I will carry a flag for it. I'll even pray with Simon on Sunday mornings. That's how bad I've got it. Whatever works for you has my blessings. Thank you. Afwan, he said, waving his hand. Only before you bury your head back in your data sets again, go see Dr. Merton. She looked worried. The boy sitting on the clinic table was 6 years old. His skin was the same deep brown as Elvie's own, but with an ashy color to it. Not dryness, but something deeper. His eyes were bloodshot like he'd been weeping. Maybe he had been. His mother stood in the corner, her arms crossed and a vicious scowl on her lips. Lucia's voice was crisp and calm, but her shoulders rode high up beside her ears. So I'm seeing this here, she said, as her finger pulled down on the boy's cheek, opening a thin gap between the lower lid and the roughened surface of the eyeball. The discoloration was almost invisible in the redness, but it was there. The faintest hint of green. I see, Elvie said. She smiled at the boy. He didn't smile back. So, Jason, how long have you had trouble seeing things? The boy shrugged. Right after my eyes started hurting again. And everything looks green? He nodded. Lucia touched Elvie's arm. Silently, the doctor shone a light into the boy's eye. The iris barely reacted, and Elvie caught a glimpse of something in the fluid behind the boy's cornea, like a badly maintained aquarium. She nodded. Lucia stood up, smiling at the woman. If you'll wait with him here, Amanda, I'll be right back. Amanda nodded once sharply. Elvie let Lucia draw her through the examining room door and down a short hallway. Outside, a stiff breeze had picked up, rattling the clinic's doors and windows. He's the only one I've seen like this, Lucia said. There's nothing in the literature. His mother doesn't seem to like me very much, Elvie said, trying to make it a joke. Her wife was shot and killed by RCE security, Lucia said. Oh. I'm sorry. The testing array was good, but it was old. 10 years, maybe 15. A long scar ran across the bottom of its screen where something had gouged at it. Elvie could believe it had made the long trek from war-torn Ganymede to come here. She was surprised it still worked, but when Lucia thumbed in her access code, the screen came to life. The sample was beautiful in its way. A branching of elegant green like a pictogram meaning tree. It began in the extracellular matrix, Lucia said. Low-level inflammation, but nothing worse than that. I hoped it would clear up on its own. Only now it's in the vitreous humor, Elvie said. I was wondering, Lucia began, but Elvie had already taken out her hand terminal and started syncing it to the array. It only took a few seconds to find a match. Elvie tapped through the data. All right, she said. The closest match is some of the rainwater organisms. Lucia shook her head, and Elvie pointed up. You know how the clouds are greenish? There's a whole biome of organisms up there that have found ways to exploit the moisture and high ultraviolet exposure. Like plants? Fungi? Like them, Elvie said.
It's not where we've been burning most of our cycles, but it looks like a pretty crowded niche. A lot of species fighting for resources. I'm guessing this little fellow was in a raindrop that dropped into Jason's eye and found a way to live there. He's had several eye infections, but they all came from familiar organisms. This thing, is it contagious, do you think? I wouldn't guess so, Elvie said. We're just as new to it as it is to us. It evolved to spread in open air through a water cycle. It's salt tolerant if it's living in us, and that's interesting. If his eyes were already compromised, he may have been vulnerable to it. But unless he starts throwing his tears at people, wouldn't think it would go too far. What about his eyesight? Elvie straightened up. Lucia looked at her seriously, almost angrily. Elvie knew it wasn't directed at her, but at the terrible ignorance they were both struggling under. I don't know. We knew something like this was bound to happen sooner or later. But I don't know what we can do about it, except tell people not to go out when it's raining. That isn't going to help him, Lucia said. Can you ask the labs back home for help? 100 objections filled Elvie's mind. I don't control the RCE research teams, and all the data analysis is planned out and running months ahead of where we are now, and I just got another sample of a third biome this morning. She tapped at her hand terminal, saving a copy of the array's data, then translating it into RCE's favored formats and sending it winging through the air back to the Israel, and then the ring, and then Earth. I'll try, she said. In the meantime, though, we need to let people know it's a problem. Has Carol Chiwiwi heard about this? She knows I'm suspicious, and that I wanted to bring you in on it, Lucia said. Elvie nodded, already trying to think what the best way would be to bring the issue to Murtry's attention. Well, you let your side know, and I'll tell mine. All right, Lucia said, and then a moment later, I hate that it breaks down that way. Your side and mine. One of my teachers back in school always used to say that contagion was the one absolute proof of community. People could pretend there weren't drug users and prostitutes and unvaccinated children all they wanted, but when the plague came through, all that mattered was who was actually breathing your air. I'm not sure if that's reassuring or awful. There's room for both, Lucia said. This scares me as much as anything that's happened. This little thing. What if we can't fix it? We probably can, Elvie said. And then we'll fix the next one, and the one after that. It's tricky and it's hard, but everything's going to be all right. Lucia lifted an eyebrow. You really believe that? Sure. Why not? You aren't scared at all? Elvie paused, thinking about the question. If I am, I don't feel it, she said. It's not something I think about. Take what blessings you can, I suppose. What about the third side? Elvie didn't know what Lucia was talking about. And then she heard Faiz's mocking voice in her memory, and her heart leaped. She hated it a little that her heart leaped, but that didn't stop her. I'll tell him, she said. I'll tell Holden. In the commissary, Holden sat hunched over his hand terminal. He'd shaved and his hair was combed. His shirt was pressed. Cleans up, pretty, a voice in the back of her mind said, and she pushed it away. A woman's voice came from the terminal, crackling and sharp. Squeeze all the balls I can get my hands around until someone starts crying, but it will take time. And I know you're thinking of taking this public because you're fucking stupid and that is what you always think of. You and publicity are like a 16-year-old boy and boobs. Nothing else in your head. So before you even begin... Amos lumbered up from the side. His smile was as open and friendly as ever, but Elvie thought there might be a little edge to it. His broad, bald head always made her think of babies, and she had to restrain herself from patting it. Hey, Amos said. Sorry, but the captain's a little busy. Who is he listening to?
United Nations, Amos said. He's been trying to get your boss to let our XO out.
Not my boss, Elvi said. Murtry Security. It's a whole different organizational structure.
That corporate stuff's not my strong suit, he said.
I just needed to, she began, and Holden drew himself up, looking into the hand terminal camera. His lips formed a hard little smile, and she lost her train of thought.
Let me make it clear, Holden said, his voice low and solid as stone, that this was done on my orders. If Royal Charter wants to put me on trial when I get back because I ordered my crew to disable their illegally weaponized shuttle, I would be happy to.
Doc,
Amos said.
What?
Sorry, no, it's just that there are some things going on that I thought he needed to know about.
Amos shook his head in something that almost passed for sorrow.
No, nothing's happening until the XO's clear.
No, it is, though, Elvi said. Not just one thing, either. I found more artifacts waking up today. Some of them are passing for local animals, I think. If we'd been here long enough to build a catalog, we could tell which were which, but as it is, everything looks new, so we don't know.
So some of the lizards are proto-molecule stuff? Amos asked.
Yes, maybe. We don't know yet. And there's more, because the local biome is starting to find ways to invade us, exploit our resources. And the perimeter dome never got set up, and so all of our microfauna are just wandering around mixing with the local ecosphere, and there's no way to get it back, so we're contaminating everything, and everything's contaminating us.
She was talking too fast. She hated this. When, if she ever got back to Earth, she was going to take some communications classes. Something that would keep her from rattling on like a can rolling downstairs.
It's all accelerating, she said. And maybe it is a reaction to us or to something we're doing. Or maybe it's not. And I know we're having trouble figuring out the politics and getting along with each other, and I'm really sorry about that.
There were tears in her eyes now. Jesus. What was she, 12?
But we have to look at what's happening, because it's really, really dangerous, and it's happening right now. And it's all going to hit a crisis point, and then something really, really bad will happen.
And then Holden was there, his eyes on her, his voice soothing. She wiped her tears with the back of her hand and wondered whether any of Jason's invading blindness fungus had been on her hands when she did it. Hey, Holden said, are you all right?
I am, she said. I'm fine. I'm sorry.
It's okay, Holden said. You said something about a crisis. She nodded. All right, he said. What would that look like?
I don't know, she said. I won't know. Not until it's happened.
Chapter 28. Baja. Baja floated above the world. 1,700 kilometers below, Illis spun past at a dizzying pace. Alex had told him that the Rocinante had an orbital period just under 2 hours, but Baja couldn't feel it. Floating outside the ship in microgravity, his inner ear told him that he was drifting, motionless. So instead, the universe appeared to spin far too quickly, like some giant child's toy. Every hour, moving from dark to light, and then an hour later back to darkness, the sun rising from behind Illis, spinning around behind him, and setting again briefly. Baja had been outside long enough to see the change 3 times, the center of his own cosmos. The planet's one vast ocean was in night. The string of islands that crossed it, tiny black spots in a larger darkness. One of the islands, the largest of them, was outlined in a faint green light. Luminescence in the waves crashing against its beaches and cliffs. The dayside was dominated by Illis's single massive continent. The southwestern quarter was the enormous desert. First landing would be just to the north of it. In daylight, it was far too small to see with the naked eye.
even the huge alien towers where he'd met with Coop and Kate and all the others in some previous lifetime were too small to find.
You okay out there, partner?
Alex's voice said over the radio.
Been drifting a while now. That hatch ain't gonna fix itself.
As he spoke, the Edward Israel passed into the daylight side of the planet and flashed like a tiny white spark. It was almost too far away to be seen, but in orbital terms, very, very close. Alex was holding the Rosinante locked in a matching orbit so he could keep his gun pointed at them.
It's beautiful, Baja said, looking back down at the planet spinning by. When we came in on the barb, I never took time to just look at it. But Illis is beautiful.
So, Alex said, his drawl adding an extra syllable to the word. Remember when we talked about the euphoria you can get on a spacewalk?
I'm not new to this, Baja replied. I know what the happies are like, and I'm good. The hatch is almost done. Just taking a break.
They'd eaten all their meals together. Alex had shared his collection of 22nd century noir revival films with him. Just the night before, they'd watched Naked Comes the Gun. Baja found noir too bleak, too hopeless to enjoy. It had led to a lengthy conversation over drinks about why Alex thought he was wrong to feel that way. And, true to Naomi's promise, Alex had dug up a list of open repair projects for Baja to work on. One of which was a sticky actuator arm on one of the Rosinante's two torpedo loading hatches. The hatch lay open next to him. A door in the flank of the warship a meter wide and 8 meters long. A massive white tube sat just below the opening. One of the ship's torpedoes. It looked too big to be just a missile. Almost a small spaceship in its own right. It didn't look dangerous, just well-crafted and functional. Baja knew that in its heart lay a warhead that could reduce another spaceship to molten metal and plasma. It was hard to reconcile that with the gentle white curves and sense of calmness and solidity. The faulty actuator had already been cut out and floated next to the ship at the end of a magnetic tether, waiting to be taken inside. With an effort, Baja turned away from the stunning view of Illis and pulled the new actuator off the web harness on his back.
Going back to work now, he said to Alex.
Roger that, the pilot replied.
Be glad to have that working.
Planning to need it? Baja asked.
Nope, but I'd like to have the option if it comes up.
Alex laughed. He laughed, but he was also serious. Baja began attaching the new arm to the hull mounts and the missile hatch. He knew almost nothing about electronics and had worried that wiring up the new device would be beyond his skills, but it turned out that it had a single plug that went into a port inside the actuator housing, which made sense when he thought about it. They would design warships around the idea that damage was inevitable. That repairs would sometimes take place in hostile environments. Making everything as modular and easy to swap out as possible wasn't just sensible, it was a survival trait. He wondered if the Martians had had a belter on the design team.
The Barbara Pecola is on our side of Illis, Alex said, still in that same lazy, sleepy voice.
Can you show me?
Baja looked around, but could see nothing but the glowing planet below and the white spark of the Edward Israel.
Hold on.
A moment later, a tiny green dot appeared on Baja's heads-up display, drifting slowly.
It's the dot?
Well, Alex said, it's where the dot is, but it's too far away to see right now. Just a sec.
A green square appeared on Baja's HUD, then zoomed in like a telescope until the distant freighter was the size of his thumbnail.
That's it 50 times, Alex said.
Space is too big, Baja replied.
It's been said, and this is just the space in low orbit around one planet. Breaks the head a bit to think about.
I try not to.
Wise man,
The Barbapicola looked like a big metal shipping container, with the squat bell housing of a drive at one end and the blocky superstructure of command and control on top. She was ugly and utterly functional. A thing of the vacuum that would never know the heat of atmospheric drag. The large cargo bays that took up most of her interior would be full of the raw lithium ore they'd already pulled off of Illis, waiting to fly to the refineries on Palace Station, waiting to be traded for food and medicine and soil enrichments, all the things the fledgling colony needed to survive. Waiting to take his daughter away.
"Can we talk to them?"
he asked.
"Huh? The Barb?
Sure.
Why?"
"My daughter is over there."
"Alrighty," came the reply, followed by a burst of static. A few moments after that, a voice with a thick belter accent replied.
"Qué? Sa bueno, baje merten me. Suche nach felsie merten, donde?"
"Sa sa,"
the voice said. The tone of fight between curiosity and irritation. The connection stayed open, but silent. While he waited, Baja finished mounting the actuator arm and plugged it in. He called down on the ship channel to have Alex test it, and it opened and closed several times without binding or twisting the hatch. The motor made a smooth vibration in the hull beneath his magnetic boots that set his helmet to humming.
"Papa?" came a hesitant voice.
"Baby, Felsie, it's me, honey," he replied,
trying to keep from babbling like an idiot and mostly failing.
"Papa,"
she said, delight coloring her voice. Deeper now, richer, but still the voice of the little girl that had squealed, "Papa," when he came home from work. It still melted all the hard, angry adult places in his heart.
"I'm up here with you, honey."
"On the Barbapicola?"
she said in confusion.
"No, I mean in orbit, over Illis. I can see your ship, honey, flying by."
"Let me find a screen. Where are you? I can look for you."
"No, don't worry about that. I'm pretty far away. Had to magnify a lot to see you. Just keep talking to me for a minute before you go around the planet again."
"Okay," she said. "Are they nice to you over there?"
Baja laughed.
"Your brother wanted to know the same thing. They're fine. The best jailers ever."
"And you?"
"Everyone is nice, but worried. Maybe the RCE ship won't let us leave."
"Everything will be fine, honey,"
Baja said, patting at the empty space as if she could see him and take comfort in it.
"Holden's working it out."
"He made you a prisoner, Papa."
"He did me a favor, Felsia. He saved me,"
Baja said, and realized it was true as he said it. Murtry would have killed him, and his son and wife were still down on the planet.
"I just wanted to say hello, not talk about that stuff."
"So hello, Papa,"
she replied with her grown-up little girl's voice.
"Hello, Podling," he replied, calling her by a nickname he hadn't used in years.
She made a strange noise, and it took Baja a moment to realize she was crying.
"Never gonna see you again, Papa," she said, her voice thick.
He started to reply with objections, with reassurances. But his conversation with Alex came back to him, and instead he said,
"Maybe, Podling. That's nobody's fault but mine. Remember that, okay? I tried to do what I thought was right, but I messed up. And it's on no one but me if I have to pay for it."
"I don't like that,"
Felsia said, still crying.
"Me either, honey," he thought, but said,
"Is what is, Sasa. Is what is.
Doesn't change that I love you and your mama and Yasek.
And Katoa, who I left to die." "They say I have to go," Felsia said. The tiny green dot that hid the massive spaceship his daughter lived on was moving away, toward the horizon into radio blackout. He could see it happening. Watch the unimaginable distance between them getting wider until a planet came between them.
Okay, honey, he said. Bye now. I love you.
Whatever she might have said in reply was lost, as the Barbapiccola slipped behind Illis, and the channel broke up into static and died. No relay satellites in orbit around the new world yet. Back to line of sight, like 19th century primitives bouncing radio around inside their atmosphere. Baja thought of his home, really just a shack in a tiny village with two dusty roads. Maybe that was appropriate. 1,700 kilometers below, his world spun. Beneath his feet, a spaceship capable of flying across the solar system hummed to itself with barely restrained power. Maybe not just like a 19th century primitive.
You're ready to come back in?
Alex said, breaking into his reverie.
In a minute, Baja replied.
Can you find first landing and point it out?
Sure. It's moving away, but you can still see it.
Another tiny green dot appeared on his HUD over a spot just north of Illis's great southern desert. Knowing where to look, Baja thought he could detect the open bowl of the mining operations north of the village, but that might just have been wishful thinking. Lucia would be down there, seeing patients, looking after Jacek. It was daylight in the village, so Lucia would definitely still be working. Baja tried to imagine what she was doing at that moment. The temptation to have Alex call down to the village so he could talk to her was almost overpowering, but he'd been selfish enough already, calling Felsia. He was a source of pain to his family now. The only comfort to be had came at their expense. So instead, he began packing up his tools and the damage actuator. If he never came back, would Lucia find someone else? He tried to tell himself that he was the sort of man who'd want that for her, that her happiness was more important than his fears about losing her. He tried the idea on like a new outfit, seeing if he could find a way to make it fit. It didn't. He saw with clarity as perfect as if Alex were zooming his HUD in on the idea that he was not that sort of man. It was hard to tell if that was a flattering testament to his commitment to his marriage or a scathing commentary on his own insecurities and selfishness. Like almost everything else that had happened to him over the last months, it was murky and difficult to navigate. He would go back with Holden, probably to the UN complex on Luna. The OPA would claim he was their citizen, but Ganymede had originally been a UN colony. The legality of which people were citizens of which government was still being worked out and would be for decades. Plenty of time to try him as a UN citizen for crimes against a UN-based company and throw him in prison for all eternity. Years of trials, probably. Baja began slowly walking across the hull of the Rosinante, dragging his webbed-together bundle of tools and spare parts behind. At the stern of the ship, he stopped and planted both feet, waiting for the bundle to float past him and stop at the end of its line. The weight pulled his arms out painfully for a moment as he killed its momentum.
"Open the cargo bay hatch," he said.
"Roger,"
Alex replied. And the ship started to vibrate under Baja's feet. The two heavy doors of the cargo bay slowly slid open. When they were about halfway, he yanked down on the line and the bundle of tools swung around the edge of the ship and into the cargo bay. He let go of the line and let them sail inside without yanking them off the edge after them. In the corner of his vision, there was a bright burst of light, like the flash of a distant camera. Baja turned to look, expecting to see one of the other two ships moving into the sunlight. Instead, there was a growing point of white light centered over Illis's largest island. It was bright enough to overpower the faint green luminescence of its beaches, and rapidly expanding. In seconds, the dark side of the planet was lit up as brightly as if a second sun had risen, the other islands in the chain suddenly visible and stark black and white, casting long shadows across the ocean as the white spot grew. He felt his heart start to race. "Alex," he said. The ocean around the big island heaved up, bulging out beyond the curve of the planet in what must have been a tsunami miles high. But before Bajja could grasp the enormity of the forces involved in such an uprising, it was gone. The island, the massive upwelling of the ocean, the smaller nearby islands, they all disappeared in a column of white fire and a rapidly rising mushroom cloud. Bajja's visor darkened dramatically, and he had a sense that if it hadn't, the light coming from the planet below might have blinded him. But even through the welder's shield darkness of the helmet, he could see the column of fire growing, hurling white vapor up until it broke free of the planet's atmosphere and became glittering crystals of ice, speeding away from the gravity well like a shower of glass from a bullet-shattered window. A massive ripple, like wind across a field of grass, sped away from the growing pillar of fire through the surrounding ocean. Intellectually, Bajja knew the ripples had to be waves, hundreds or thousands of feet high, rushing away from the blast. But the intellectual part of his brain was rapidly disappearing behind the screaming primitive who was relieving his bladder into the suit's condom catheter in fear. Bajja had grown up in the Jupiter system. He'd seen video of Io up close more than once. Io was famous for having the most massive volcanoes ever seen by man. Gigantic geysers of sulfur blasting out of the surface of the moon until particles were flung into Jupiter's plasma torus and faint ring system. They made Io an almost insanely inhospitable place. The explosion Bajja was looking at from orbit dwarfed those eruptions. It looked like half the planet was being flattened by the force of the blast. His initial thought was that it was a very good thing First Landing was on the other side of the world. His second, that the shock wave was heading that direction, and not even traveling around the planet was going to slow it down much.
"Jesus Christ!" Alex yelled across the radio. "Are you seeing that shit?"
"Call down," Bajja tried to yell back. It came out as a panicky whimper.
"You have to warn them."
"Warn them to do what?"
Alex asked. He sounded dazed. "What do you do when the planet you're standing on tries to kill you?" Bajja didn't know. Chapter 29. Holden. Holden stood on a low hill overlooking First Landing, trying to enjoy the beauty of the planet while his brain chewed on the half-dozen insoluble problems that he was somehow supposed to solve. The usual dust had been tamped down by the recent run of gentle rains. It made the town look clean, well-tended, peaceful. Above, the sky was a stunning indigo blue, with just the faintest streamers of high-altitude clouds breaking it up. His hand terminal was reporting the temperature as 22 degrees Celsius with a gentle 4-knot wind coming out of the northeast. The only thing that would have made it better was Naomi there with him, or at least back safe on the Rossi. But that would have made it a lot better.
"I miss planets," Holden said, closing his eyes and facing the sun.
"I don't," Amos replied.
He'd been so quiet during their afternoon walk that Holden had sort of forgotten he was there.
"You never miss a breeze, the sun on your skin, a gentle rain?"
"Those are not the parts of planetary life that imprinted on my memory," Amos replied.
"Want to talk about it?" Holden asked.
"Nope."
"Okay."
Holden didn't take the mechanic's refusal personally. Amos had, as he described it, a lot of past in his past. He didn't like people digging around there, and Holden was the last person to pry. Holden already knew more about Amos's brutal upbringing on Earth than he wanted to.
"Better head back, I guess,"
Holden said after a few more